I'm Nahla Ayed, host of Ideas. In this age of clickbait and online shouting, Ideas is a meeting ground for people who want to deepen their understanding of the world. Join me as we crack open a concept to see how it plays out over place and time and how it matters today. From the rise of authoritarianism to the history of cult movies, no idea is off limits. Ideas is on the CBC Listen app or wherever you find your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Nora Young. This is Spark. Science fiction is full of robots and androids as helpers, as existential menace, as victims of our hubris. In fiction, robots let us explore questions like, what responsibility do we have for the things we create? What do we owe future generations? And what really makes us human when our technical creations can outperform us?
It is a lot to consider.
But now, in the real world, strides in AI software are finding their way into physical robots. It's promising a new era of human-robot interaction, where robots can assist us, respond to our needs, and to changes in their environment. Question is, are we ready for robots among us? Nine years ago on Spark, we ran a documentary about a couple named Henry and Jane Evans. At the time, Henry was developing and testing robots designed to extend the capabilities of people with disabilities, including himself.
Freedom, independence, and enjoyment. And then I crashed.
Nearly a decade on, we wanted to check back in with them. Turns out there's a new robot in their life to help Henry reach a new level of independence. It's called Stretch RE2, or Stretch for short.
Stretch has allowed me to participate with Jane in household tasks and to work together with her. This makes me seem more like a partner and less of a burden. My name is Henry Evans. In 2002, I became quadriplegic and mute after a stroke-like attack. Now, working with Robots for Humanity, I am a pioneer in adaptive robotic tech to help myself and other disabled people like me navigate the world.
Henry speaks through a text-to-voice program using a head tracker, which converts tiny head movements into cursor movements on his computer. He slowly moves his head up and down and side to side to spell each word. For our conversation, Henry prepared the answers spoken by the computer-generated voice ahead of time. But whenever he thinks of something to say in the moment, he rolls his eyes towards the ceiling to request a letter board, a rectangular translucent board with sets of letters in various places. Jane holds it up, follows his eyes, and calls out the letters he focuses on,
M-O.
Spelling words as he goes.
Even if it's not as, okay, F, A.
Hi, I'm Jane Evans. I'm Henry's wife and caregiver as well. It's been an incredible journey with Henry. It's something we never expected when we were married in 1987. But, you know, life can throw you some curveballs sometime, but what do you want to do with it?
For several years, Henry and Jane have experimented with different assistive robots in their home. The most recent is Stretch, a robot that's added a new layer of autonomy to Henry's life and helped strengthen his connections with others.
Stretch had an immediate and significant impact on my relationship with my granddaughter, Teddy. We mounted an iPad on Stretch, with me in the video feed. For the first time, Teddy saw me able to physically manipulate my environment and play with her. She began talking to me, and even hugged me goodbye, something she had never done before. It was really quite remarkable.
Over the past three summers, Henry's worked with a team of researchers to discover all kinds of ways to use Stretch, including, to Jane's surprise, handing her a rose.
It was amazing. So they were planning something. You could see, you know, they were in the garden and things like that. Every time I came around, they were quiet. But I walked into our bedroom, and there was Henry with Stretch. I kind of glanced at Henry and didn't realize it at first because I wasn't expecting it. And all of a sudden, when I actually saw the robot holding the rose, and then Henry is moving the robot towards me, I started to cry. And part of that was I knew what it took for him to do that. the effort that went behind that. And as I told him, out of all the roses in the world, that was the most beautiful one for me. It was just, now I'm getting choked up just thinking about it. It was incredible. It was the work behind it. It was the love behind it, summed up all into one. It was incredible.
Can you give me a couple of other examples of how Henry's collaboration with Stretch has enhanced your relationship?
So a good example is when he uses Stretch to help me take the dirty laundry to where it needs to be, or to help me carry dishes with Stretch. It's Henry actually using Stretch on his computer to tell the robot, go to the kitchen, and then, you know, I load the dishes or the silverware or whatever it is. And so it gave Henry a sense of, oh yeah, this is why it takes so long when Jane is bringing things. This is why sometimes she's not here. And even though he's done this a million times before he was paralyzed, it was a reminder of, yeah, this is what it takes. So I felt it brought him more into my world. When you have someone in your family that cannot move or talk, they actually go into another world. I noticed this because on average, I have to ask Henry a question two or three times before he answers it. And I asked him one time, you in another world, right? And he looked up at me and said, yes, I actually run and I invent, I do all these things and I'm young again. So it's pretty neat, although I have to remind him, I'm not part of that world.
Right.
You need to come back here.
The dishes need to get done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's what Stretch enabled. It kind of bridged that gap because he's now using the robot to do everyday tasks.
Henry, I find this interesting that we tend to think of robots as doing things for us, but in some ways, Stretch has made more work for you in some ways because you're participating in tasks more, but I guess it's also given you more autonomy.
Okay, he wants to use a letterboard for that? A, B, absolutely. T, H, A, that's T, H, E, that's the M, A, I, N, that's the main, T, H, thing, E, V, every, E, V, E, N, that's the main thing, even, I, F, even if, I, T, it's, N, O, even if it's not, A, S, even if it's not as, okay, F, A, S, T, even if it's not as fast, A, as, S, O, someone else doing it.
Yeah. Henry, can you talk a bit about the mission for Robots for Humanity and how the organization has evolved since we last talked to you back in 2015?
We have just kept going with speeches, awards, classroom lectures, many technology evaluations, or interviews, etc. Additionally, every summer we host various robotics research groups for several weeks at our house, including Hello Robot with Stretch.
Henry, what are some of the recent advancements with Stretch that you're most excited about?
Hello Robot is developing software which allows me to pre-program movements for Stretch to execute when I ask, like bringing a spoon to my mouth. They have also developed software which allows Stretch to self-navigate to any part of my house once I click somewhere on the house floor plan. Carnegie Mellon researchers also developed a device which allows me to control Stretch with only my head movements. It also helps Stretch autonomously navigate into the correct position for easily grasping an object in 3D space.
Wow. I understand one of your favorite things to do with Stretch is something called freestyling. So what's freestyling?
Freestyling is when we sit around and come up with random things for Stretch to try to do. For example, we wondered if Stretch could go down the hall, locate the printer, turn it on, wait while I printed a file, and then pick up what printed and bring it to me. I was dubious, but it was surprisingly easy.
What's the hardest part of the programming process, Henry?
Stretch uses extremely high-level programming, so once you understand what everything does, it's generally pretty straightforward. Easily the biggest challenge is getting the base into the correct position using only the controls.
The base of the robot.
I'm going to elaborate a little bit on that. The reason that is so critical is, for example, if he wants to turn on a light switch, if that face is off by just a little bit, when the arm comes up to turn on the light switch, it's going to miss it.
Right.
So it's actually critical. It's in the same position when he's turning on a certain, for example, a light switch. It's absolutely critical.
I see. Jane, you've talked about how stretch enhances your relationship with Henry as his wife, but what kind of impact does the robot have on your life as a caregiver?
So, for example, when I'm mentioning, like, grabbing the utensils, the dishes to bring it to the bedroom, you could say, well, we don't live in this ginormous house. Why don't you just go and do it? And you don't need a robot to do that. But again, if you look at that over time, the amount of trips going back and forth, okay, I grabbed the dinner, okay, I grabbed the silverware, oh, wait a minute, I had a glass of water, oh, wait a minute, the condiments. If you do that even in a week's time for meals, that's a lot of time. And that's time taken away from him, from Henry. I have to be spending time with him. And as a caregiver, I could be saying something like, I don't know, we could be talking about, oh, we've got this coming up. We've got these people coming into the house. We've got these speeches coming up. Oh, we got a luncheon at this date, you know, or just planning things with the family, whatever. It's the time that it saves, and I'm able to be not only a better wife, but a better caregiver.
So it sounds like on one level, it helps you, you know, save your time for more important things, more interpersonal things. But does it also sort of just free up some of your mental space so that you're not?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's the gift of time that I call. And it, yes, you know, because texts are coming in, you know, from family members, from friends, from, you know, and it even allows me to take care of all those little things. Yeah. Or Henry has an itch. That's something we don't think about as able-bodied people. But he might have an itch. And if I'm in the kitchen, he's sitting here just with this incredible itch. If I can scratch his head, his ears, you know, whatever, it's, I'm there. I'm present.
Are there any other examples of day-to-day assisting that either one of you would like to mention?
Henry's got one. W-H-I-L. Was L right, Henry? W-I-R-E. Wiping M, my face. A-N and E-F-E-E. Feeding M, me. Wiping my face and feeding me. Is that what you want to say? Okay. And again, I want to reiterate the itches because I can't imagine having, for example, an itch in my nose and waiting for somebody to come. You know, if you think about it, that happens so often. Or adjusting Henry in the bed. Sit on a chair and don't move just for even 3 minutes. And you need, we do these small movements even when we're sitting. And it's to relieve pressure. And Henry has sensation everywhere. And so I'm constantly moving him the way he directs me by just moving his head of where to position his body. All those are critical. So Henry wants to add something else. Let's see. A, D, J, U, adjust, B, L, A, blanket. A, N, adjust blanket, and A, C, D, A, S, and basically, A, N, anything, any T, H, I, and basically any time, I, T, W, A, want, T, to, M, move, S, so, S, O, some, T, thing, something, L, I, like, F, L, I, P, flip the L light switch. Yeah, it's basically to help him move and something as easy as flipping a light switch.
You are listening to Spark.
I think it's an idea of slowing down a little bit and considering the human context into which you're putting new technology.
This is Spark
from CBC.
I'm Nora Young, and today on Spark, we're talking about human collaboration with assistive robots and how it can help people with disabilities and their caregivers feel both cared for and capable. Right now, my guests are Henry and Jane Evans. 22 years ago, Henry suffered a brainstem dissection, a very rare stroke leaving him paralyzed and mute. Since then, he's been exploring how assistive robots can help expand his abilities.
Does it change the nature of the interpersonal relationship between the two of you that you're not, I don't want to say make it more equal, but that Henry, you're not waiting for her to do something for you, and Jane, you're not feeling like you have to respond so much to his needs? Does it change the way you relate to each other in that sense, because Stretch can do these types of tasks rather than waiting for you to do them?
Okay, Henry wants to add to that. I feel less of a burden, A-D-E, because I-D don't, H have, T because I don't have to, C-O-N constantly, A-C-B, I don't have to constantly B-O-S-T bother, J, Jane.
Mm.
And so I think that's a good point when he says, I feel less of a burden, because we want to say, oh, no, don't feel like a burden. This is not your fault, which is true. But when I put myself in Henry's shoes, and this was something small. I had a hysterectomy and had to be in bed for a few weeks, but it really opened my eyes up to me that, you know, yeah, you do start to feel like a burden. Because life is so busy that all of a sudden it's like, oh yeah, one more thing. And so the question comes, how do you make it so that that person doesn't feel like a burden? And if it means that a robot is standing by him, for example, with a towel, and every time he needs to scratch his face, he leans into the towel and rubs his nose or his cheek, whatever. Something that small is huge. And I understand Henry feeling that way, but I always remind him this is something we have to work through together. Is it easy for him? Is it easy for me? No. But what did you say, Henry? We both have become one. We just need to figure out now if we're male or female.
Henry, do you think the future of home robots is less about making these sort of humanoid automatons that act like people and more about robots as tools to assist humans, like to help us rather than replace us?
Absolutely. The first thing robots are being used for is as tools to assist humans. The ones I am familiar with cannot even make decisions autonomously. Whether or not they also become humanoid automatons that act like people is quite a ways from today's robots, and not something I could confidently predict.
Henry, if you were to paint a picture of a sort of an ideal future when it comes to human-robot interaction, what would it look like?
You could control the robot just by thinking about it, making the robot the ultimate body surrogate.
Super interesting. Jane, how about you? What would you like to see assistive robots like Stretch do in the next little while?
So for me, voice control is very important, because Henry calls this the caregiver principle. If you have to set up a computer and have all, you know, make it complex, wires, or blah, 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 nobody's going to use it. So a caregiver, the main challenge is time, because we're being torn in so many different directions. So I would love to see a robot be so simple that you could just talk to it with your voice. It would understand you. I would love to see it know automatically what to do. Certain things that are mundane, everyday things, that it could start doing that with even, you know, just a voice saying, Stretch, do the morning routine, for example, and it would know what to do. The robot would have its own things to do, and I would have my own things to do. One thing we did with the robot last summer that was very helpful was it helped me exercise. Because as a caregiver, you need to just keep up your exercise, to have the stamina. the stamina to keep going day by day. And just having a robot sitting there counting as I was doing sit-ups or saying, 3, 2, 1, go. You're not going to tell the robot, oh, guess what? I'm not in the mood today.
Right.
It's almost like you have to be accountable to this. So that was really, really cool. And I would love to see, you know, breaking down a caregiver's world with just the tasks in the house, exercising, you know, little things, nice music. And here's the beauty of having a robot. You don't have to deal with somebody in a bad mood. It's like, robot's always going to be there, as happy as can be. Yeah, yeah, that's what I love. So voice control is very, very big. It's very big on my list.
Okay, thanks for that. Last question for each of you. What's the biggest gift that Stretch has given you?
Using Stretch to do things for myself gives me an increased level of self-worth. It has also improved my relationships by enabling me to express myself physically. Finally, it allows me to once again exert my will on my environment, which is rewarding.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Jane?
The gift that Stretch has given me is hope. It's hope in the future. Are we ever going to replace a human being with a robot? No, we never will. But just knowing as a caregiver that you have this tool to help you through the day is huge. Absolutely huge. Mm.
Thank you both so much for sharing your insights on this.
Thank you for having us. This is an honor.
Henry Evans is the inspiration for and instigator of Robots for Humanity. He was joined by his wife and caregiver, Jane.
Have you ever longed to escape reality or fantasized about stepping into someone else's shoes, even for just a little while? Hi, I'm Laura Mullen.
And I'm Chris Tolley. We host CBC's Play Me, the immersive podcast that transforms theater into addictive audio fiction. Join us for a new season and disappear into a world rich with drama, where every show delivers hypnotizing stories and unveils intriguing characters with secrets.
Play Me wherever you get your podcasts.
Nora Young, and today on Spark, we're talking about human-robot interaction. Beyond working on the factory floor or tackling dangerous jobs, what do we actually want robots to be for? Like, how do we get the kind of robots that Henry and Jane are hoping for, where we can ask them to load the dishwasher, warm up the leftover pasta, or safely collaborate alongside you to help you do your job? Let's ask this guy.
When we say robot, today we typically mean it's complicated.
This is Tom Williams. He's an associate professor of computer science at the Colorado School of Mines.
I'm a computer scientist and cognitive scientist, and my lab studies how we can design robots to be not only more effective, but to be designed in ways that are more equitable and ethical.
When humans are together, we share information and communicate goals in a variety of ways. We don't just write out a list of instructions for the other person to follow. You ask me a question, I tap you on the shoulder to get your attention. You show me a photo of that doohickey you want me to find. It's multimodal.
When we talk about multimodality in robotics, we mean that there are multiple different modes of communication that you could use to communicate with the robot.
So maybe to have effective human-robot interaction, we need that same kind of flexible communication.
I like this idea.
Yeah.
And beyond that, says Tom, maybe we can bring in entirely new modes of communicating.
We're also seeing more non-human-like ways of communication being brought into robotics as well. So there's a lot of recent work on augmented reality in robotics, mm-hmm. for example, where maybe you're working with a robot in a factory while you're wearing glasses, and as the robot is talking to you, visualizations are appearing over the things that the robot is talking to you about. This is not something like we cannot usually, as humans, induce these types of hallucinations into people's field of view. But hey, maybe robots can. And so robots have a lot of tools at their disposal beyond just how humans communicate that allow them to communicate in new and exciting ways.
Yeah. So can you talk about some of the work that's currently being done at your interactive robotics lab, like specifically when it comes to applying cognitive psychology to designing robots that are language capable?
So the sort of heart of what our lab does is focused around how can we take these insights from cognitive psychology, from linguistics, from philosophy, from these other fields of study, and bring them in to inform how we design our robot systems. And a lot of the times, this has to do with psychological theories of human memory and the ways that memory and language connect in humans. So we know in humans, for example, we have different types of memory. We've got our long-term memory of just things we are aware of. We have our episodic memory of events that we've experienced. We have our working memory or our short-term memory of a small amount of really relevant information that we're keeping on hand because it's probably going to be useful in the future. And so one thing we do, for example, in robotics is say, maybe we should be giving robots those same types of systems as well.
Okay.
If we give the robot a model of the really important things in the conversation or the things that it thinks the people it's talking to are probably thinking about at any given point in time, that can allow the robot to communicate much more naturally and effectively. And this manifests in the ways we use pronouns or things like it or this or that. If I use it to refer to something, that only sort of makes sense if I'm talking about the single thing in the conversation that we're both really, really focused on. Otherwise, it's going to be way too ambiguous. And so in order to use that type of really concise language, you have to be tracking what the person you're talking to is thinking about in the conversation and what maybe they think that you are thinking about in the conversation. And our lab's argument is the best way to do that is to take theories from psychology and bring them into robotics.
And is the idea here that this approach is more likely to be better in sort of real world type of situations rather than sort of a logic tree where you're saying, you know, if this, then this, because it's a lot harder to do if this, then this in an actual real world situation?
If you are having a robot try to interact in some real human environment, you can't just pre-script out every single thing the robot is going to say.
Right.
If I want to talk to a robot and ask it to bring me something, say, my lunch is in the fridge, it's in the blue Tupperware container, go get it for me. Not only can I not sort of pre-script that because there's so many different descriptions that might need to play out there, but in that example I just gave, it's actually pretty likely that the robot has never seen this object before, because otherwise I wouldn't need to give this complicated description. So not only can we not pre-script out the particular patterns of words, but we need to enable robots to understand and generate language about things they've never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And again, our argument is, well, we've got all these theories from psychology for how humans do this type of work, which you're not going to get out of a machine learning approach where you need thousands of data points of previous examples to train on. And that's why we leverage those types of techniques.
Yeah. And so then what is imitation learning and how is that different from how robots have typically been programmed in the past?
So there's a lot of cool work being done right now in robotics on new types of machine learning that are a little bit different from the classic types of machine learning that you might see in other parts of computer science. In a lot of computer science, artificial intelligence relies on huge data sets where you have thousands or millions of examples of previous things you've encountered with some classification of this is what should have been done in this context and this is what should have been done in this context. But if you're trying to teach a robot how to pick up a mug, you're not going to have millions of examples.
Right.
And even right. If you have videos from YouTube, they're probably not going to be from the perspective of the robot's camera, and that might not really teach the robot how to perform that task. So what somebody in imitation learning, learning from demonstration, programming by demonstration, what somebody who uses those types of techniques might do is say, well, let's literally show the robot how to do it. We'll move the robot's arm, we'll show it how to perform this action we're trying to teach it how to do. And then we'll just do that a couple times with maybe different configurations. What if the mug is over here? What if it's inside of a box, et cetera? And then it's the machine learning algorithm's job from that point to generalize those different trajectories in order to have some new pattern that captures that general behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But just from a couple examples, as opposed to, you know, thousands of videos.
But I mean, in terms of behaving with what we might think of as common sense or intelligence in these real world situations, this seems like a very, very hard problem, right? Like we humans have developed all these super subtle ways of communicating our emotions, our intentions and all that. And a lot of it is tacit and we still get it wrong. So can you tell me about some of the challenges to actually making this kind of approach work?
Yeah. Common sense reasoning in general is a huge challenge in robotics. People have tried in the past to develop complicated methods of encoding the everyday facts that people would know about the world and that you can take for granted as you enter an interaction. That's really hard because you're sort of hard coding out lots of very specific information.
Yeah.
On the other hand, now with large language models, it seems like something like ChatGPT, you might be able to ask questions about what an everyday person would know or be able to reason about in this situation. And, you know, ChatGPT isn't going to be able to reason about, or it doesn't do a good job of reasoning about spatial information that a robot needs to handle, about all the objects it knows about and where they are and things like that. But it can answer questions pretty easily about what room in the house are you most likely to find an oven in and things like that that we consider common sense information. One of the big challenges there is with either of these approaches, whether you are coding in the facts that you want a robot to know about how we relate to our environment, or whether you're just handing it off to a big model like ChatGPT, ultimately, you're encoding just one particular perspective. There is no one single set of facts that is truly universal. Even things as simple as what does food look like, what does soap look like in images of what you might see in your environment can vary dramatically from context to context.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, handing off to ChatGPT, you might be able to get some quick answers back about some common sense information in a home environment, but it might only really work within, you know, a certain cultural context, a certain type of home environment. And it doesn't necessarily solve the problem of how to make sure that we are able to establish that type of common sense reasoning across different type of types of cultural contexts and for different types of people.
And is generative AI that drives applications like ChatGPT, is that on its way into the physical world through robotics?
Yeah, there are a lot of different ways that people in the field of robotics are starting to use things like ChatGPT. One way is simply as a way of doing planning. So I say that I want to achieve some task, you throw it to ChatGPT, and it will give you a set of step-by-step instructions. And then as long as you can translate those one by one into specific pieces of code that should be triggered, then that might be a way of enabling the robot to leverage that common sense information in order to do tasks in the environment. Other people are using ChatGPT and similar models just as the end-to-end system for how a robot communicates and saying, everything the robot says is going to just be determined by ChatGPT. That's going to handle all the dialogue. Another way that ChatGPT is being used in the way that we use it in my lab, for example, is not to handle all of language because there's a lot of ethical risks that come along with using something like ChatGPT to handle all of your language, especially because ChatGPT makes things up.
Yes, right.
You can't really trust what it's going to say or do. And thus, especially when robots can be causing physical harm by the actions they take in the environment, because they can be causing emotional harm by saying things that are insensitive or persuading people to do things that they really shouldn't be doing. We've been thinking about, well, are there ways to use these models to solve certain small pieces of the robot's intelligence without sort of abdicating all of the decisions about what the robot will say off to the model? Finally, there are some people who are using things like ChatGPT just as a layer on top of their existing systems in order to make them more accessible. For example, maybe they have a system that people can already speak to pretty fluently in English, and then throwing ChatGPT on top just to do the translation to a different language might allow it to very quickly and easily be usable by people who don't speak in the dominant languages of the programming team without needing to do a lot of extra sort of linguistics work under the hood.
From the Spark Archives, 2020, Frank Pasquale, author of New Laws of Robotics.
So Asimov's laws of robotics were incredibly powerful and inspired robot technology. The one problem I see with them is that they are really focused on making sure that robots do good and do more good than harm. But I was more concerned about the problem of power. How do we make sure that human beings always are in charge of robotics and AI? And so in developing my laws of robotics, I tried to look at it from the perspective of a lawyer and thinking, how could we develop some basic principles that could lead to institutions that would keep humans in charge and make sure that even if robots were doing good things in general, that we were able to democratically control them.
From the CBC Archives, 1960-something, science fiction writer Isaac Asimov.
Well, of course, the three laws of robotics were originally invented by me in order to avoid the Frankenstein motive, because before I wrote my stories, most robot stories were filled with this Frankenstein bit about the robot destroying its creator. However, I was asked to write a robot story to end all robot stories, so I wrote one in which robots became so intelligent that by any reasonable definition, they define themselves as human beings, you see. So that now the three laws of robotics became the three laws of humanics. And we're right back to the Frankenstein motif. I received letters from readers saying, does this mean you're never going to write any more robot stories? And I wrote back saying, don't worry, if I think of a good robot story, I'll write it anyway.
This is Spark.
This is Spark.
From CBC.
I'm Nora Young. Right now, my guest is computer scientist and cognitive scientist Tom Williams. We've been talking about how using what we know from human psychology can help better design autonomous robots, robots which will be integrated with generative AI more and more. Now, as we heard earlier in the show with Henry Evans, there are also teleoperated robots, and these can offer something that autonomous robots don't, specifically when it comes to human-robot interaction.
Teleoperated robots are actually one of the oldest topics within human-robot interaction. It's one of the things that people have been working on the longest. And this is in part because of the role that the space exploration context has played in the field of human-robot interaction. So if we're talking about robots on Mars, for example, maybe we're not interested in socially interacting with those robots that are very far away. But if we need to control that robot as it's driving around Mars, there's really interesting challenges there because of the latency and the time delay, where the robot might need to be semi-autonomous driving around, but receiving periodic commands from the human at some latency. And so because of that, there's been a long history of work on teleoperation in robotics. In addition, though, on the social side, one of the things my lab has worked on is the use of teleoperated robots in domains like education or therapy or areas like that. And in those domains, the robots are really being used as stand-ins for puppets. So you can imagine, like in an educational context or a therapeutic context, an educator or a therapist might use a puppet for a certain purpose and have kids talk with the puppet. You can imagine it might be easier for kids to choose to interact with that puppet, even though they know it's connected to the arm of the teacher, than it is for them to talk about the same things with the teacher.
Right.
And in the same way, people are using robots now for those same purposes. So the educator might have a tablet where they can control what the robot says. They might be able to drive the robot around, and they'll have groups of kids who are interacting with the robot. The kids are going to be much more interested in the robot than the teacher, and they'll be more willing to talk to and engage socially with that robot than with the adult. But it provides maybe a more compelling and engaging form of interaction than if it were a literal puppet. And so we're seeing more and more uses of these teleoperated robots in social domains where the goal isn't to use them as a step towards autonomy. And instead, we know that the caregivers who are working with the kids really want to use teleoperated systems in order to maintain their own agency, their own control over the system, as opposed to sort of abdicating control to whatever the technology designers decided to program into the system.
Yeah. Can we talk about the sort of overall philosophical approach here? Like, should we be designing robots to replace humans, to replace human jobs, or designing robots that work with us?
At least within the education domain, most people who I know who are working in robotics for education are not trying to use robots to replace people. They're not trying to design robot teachers, right? Often in education, robots are used as teaching assistants, or you might think of them as, let's say you've got a classroom of kindergartners who are doing different activities. Maybe some of them are rotating through working with the robot on math exercises, and that allows the teacher to spend more one-on-one time with everybody, just not at the same time. And it's sort of providing another activity in the same way that maybe you'd have kids playing an educational video game or something like that. But we know that kids learn better from embodied artifacts, so they will learn more effectively, they'll learn faster when they're working with a robot than they would if they were just interacting with like an app on a screen.
Right.
There is a larger debate here, though, about robots replacing people. There's a lot of ethical concerns right now about the extent to which robots are being used to replace people in factories and areas like that, which are really serious concerns. There are a lot of manufacturing companies that are now increasingly investing in collaborative robots, where robots are working alongside people instead of replacing people. Even in those cases, there are some concerns, though, about whether that's being done just as a stepping stone towards ultimately replacing people, or whether it's genuinely in the name of collaboration. And even if it's fully teleoperated and there's no replacement, there are concerns. In an increasing number of cases, we're seeing robots being used in factory environments and other types of similar labor contexts where the people operating the robots are not in the factory, are living somewhere else. They might be in other countries that have less stringent labor laws and are having their labor exploited through the tool of this teleoperated system.
Right.
So even when the robot isn't replacing a job, there are real concerns about the ways it's still fundamentally changing the labor context in ways that are inequitable. Mm-hmm. We're not seeing as much of that in the educational context, but there have been examples of that. There was a robot Enki that was used in South Korean English language classrooms that was teleoperated by workers in the Philippines. The kids were told the robot was autonomous and it had this sort of white feminine avatar on a screen, but the robot's facial expressions were all being driven by the facial movements of the teachers in the Philippines who were remote controlling the robots, who were having their labor erased. And so even in education, we do have concerns and try to be careful to make sure that those types of things aren't happening, and that when we are using robots for teleoperation, it's being done in a way that helps reduce the otherwise invisible labor of the educators rather than creating these new opportunities for labor extraction.
From the Spark Archives, 2011. Andrew Goldenberg, founder of the field of robotics at University of Toronto.
My interpretation of that desire of mimicking the human is to actually make the robots acceptable by humans, to work with humans and have them interact naturally, quote unquote. If you imagine that machines are moving around, they don't look like humans, they would possibly look awkward, or the humans would not be tempted to work with them, to engage in them or with them. So I think that it's something natural that we try to replicate ourselves. So for the time being, really, it's more of a desire to explore the ability to embody human characteristics in machines. Mm-hmm. That is a challenge. It's something that academics and researchers are fascinated by.
I'm Nora Young. Today on Spark, we're talking about robot-human interaction and how to design robots ethically. Right now, my guest is computer and cognitive scientist Tom Williams, director of the Mirror Lab in Colorado. In a recent paper, he looked at how social and historical factors have shaped the way robots are designed.
When I was engaging in this research project, one of the things that really surprised me was learning about where some of our imagery around robots comes from. Now, as a roboticist, you would think that I would have some idea about where robots came from. And, you know, I mentioned before, yes, like Carl Chapek's play, Rawson's Universal Robots. This is what everybody talks about when you talk about the origins of robotics. But as I was researching this project, I came across a fascinating dissertation from a literary scholar who made a really compelling argument that our image of robotics and what robots look like, what they are for, and how they operate in our society can be traced back to this very specific moment in time in the aftermath of the United States Civil War. Specifically, in the late 1860s, a pair of engineers from New Jersey designed this new steam-powered robot that was supposed to be a robotic man pulling a cart. And if you look at the actual robot they prototyped, it looks pretty innocuous. However, if you look at the patent that they filed before they actually prototyped it, the robot is very clearly designed in this pretty egregious racist stereotype, where it is depicted in this caricature of a black man, and specifically in this outfit that aligns with a character from minstrel shows in the 1860s.
Right.
Now, this early robot they created didn't go anywhere, but the impact it had was on pop culture. So a couple months after the patent came out, a book was released inspired by the patent. The front cover was basically a picture of the patent, but illustrated in more cartoon form. And the story, The Steam Man of the Prairies, the general premise of the story is there's this young white boy who is carried by this black mechanical man westward. It's not a great story, but it had a really strong impact on popular culture. It spawned this whole genre of early science fiction stories called Edison Aids that had these young white boys mastering all sorts of other types of technology, including some of the early science fiction work in Europe, which went on to help inspire things like Rawson's Universal Robots. So while Rawson's Universal Robots and Isaac Asimov's stories are where we get the words for robot and robotics, those pieces of popular culture were themselves inspired by this particular moment in time where the mechanical person was being used as a vehicle, first for conveying this message about what white men in the American South were going to do with the end of slavery as their existing power structures were crumbling, and then later in Europe with the rise of the women's suffrage movement, as men in France were wondering what were they going to do as their power advantage was poised to go away.
Mm-hmm. Do you think when you look at the field of robotics, given all we've been talking about in terms of, you know, the political dimension, the culture dimension, the labor dimension, are those questions being sufficiently grappled with in robotics now, do you think?
The questions around labor in robotics have attracted a lot of attention. There has been a lot of work over decades on the labor dimensions of robotics. There have been these long-standing conversations about the role that robotics are playing in our society in order to fill these specific holes that were left with the end of the United States slave system. In terms of topics around race and gender, these are also topics that in pop culture have been investigated for a long time. Again, Rawson's Universal Robots, where the word robot comes from. It's about labor and workers' rights, but it's also about slavery and gender equality. There's an abolitionist character in the play. And these types of issues have been prevalent in our pop culture for a long time. On the academic side, I think that roboticists are only recently really beginning to grapple with these types of topics. Even gender. Over the past 15 years, there's been more and more work on issues of gender in robotics. But for a long time, the questions people were asking were things like, how do men and women see robots differently? What do men and women want robots to be used for? And to some extent, that is important because you want to make sure that we aren't just designing robots that fit the needs and desires and preferences of one segment of the population. But on the other hand, it's not really grappling with these questions about the ways that our choices in the robot design process are reinforcing stereotypes or how the morals and values and principles we're programming into robots might be reinforcing the values and preferences of only a specific subset of potential robot users. And over the past couple years, that's really begun to change, and we're seeing more and more research that is beginning to grapple with these questions. And I think some of this has to do with the trajectory of the field. We started the interview talking about cognitive psychology, right? I'm a cognitive scientist. And in many ways, that is the dominant field that a lot of robotics has historically drawn on. Taking insights from cognitive psychology and human factors psychology and these other areas that are very focused on the individual person's cognition. But now we're starting to see more emphasis on the sociological dimensions of robots and these higher level questions about how we design robots that you don't really get at if you're only looking at the interactions right with a single person, and you have to be thinking about interactions with groups and societies.
And just finally, Tom, what do you think needs to happen to make sure that language-capable robots are designed and deployed in ways that are ethical and responsible and equitable?
I think that going forward, roboticists need to do a couple of things. The first thing that roboticists need to do is simply pay attention to these types of questions that historically they have been blind to or even actively antagonistic towards, and understanding that, yes, if you are designing a technology that is designed to depict a person, then you can't ignore who that robot is depicting. Mm-hmm. You can't ignore questions of what the robot looks like and what voice you're giving the robot and what effect that might have on real people and real communities. The other thing that we need to do, though, is rethink how we are going about designing robots and question how much of that design work we should be doing ourselves. There's been a great movement over the past couple years led by scholars like Sasha Costanza-Chalk on this idea of design justice. And part of what design justice encourages us to question is, who are we considering to be designers? Who is doing design work? And where should the development of technologies really be happening? Of course, a lot of robotic engineering, because of the nature of robotics, is going to happen in the robotics lab. But questions about what should the robot's voice sound like? What principles should the robot follow? How should the robot talk? Maybe these are decisions that should be made by communities. Mm-hmm. Perhaps instead of trying to design a single robot that will work in every situation for everyone, we should be working with communities to build robots that will work for those communities, and then giving the communities the tools they need in order to design the robot's appearance and voice and principles for themselves without needing people from a robot lab to be involved.
Yeah. Tom, thanks so much for your insights on this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tom Williams is the director of the Minds Interactive Robotics Research Lab at the Colorado School of Mines. You've been listening to Spark. The show was made by Michelle Parisi, Samarui Johannes, Megan Carty, and me, Nora Young, and by Henry Evans, Jane Evans, and Tom Williams.
And from the Spark Archives, Frank Pasquale and Andrew Goldenberg. Subscribe to Spark on the free CBC Listen app or your favorite podcast app. I'm Nora Young. Talk to you soon.
Here, a robot that never sleeps nor winks nor looks out the window. One little robot always remembers to serve drinks when it sees anyone walking around with a thirst. Some robots have even learned to fly. Someday, maybe someone will invent a robot that can take a joke.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.